Our next speaker in the session is going to be Peter Grossman. And Peter's going to talk about greenhouse gas impacts of landscape conservation practices. There it is.
Good morning, and I'd like to thank Jorge for organizing the symposium. It was great fun to participate in a symposium that was held both at the Soil and Water Conservation Society and also here at SSSA, and I'd like to thank Jorge. And also, I'd like to acknowledge my co-author on this presentation, so Art Gold at the University of Rhode Island. And I'm going to be presenting some research that we've been involved in that was funded through grants from the USDA, National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and also from the National Science Foundation. So I'm going to first start off with So now we're trying to think about the landscape scale. So in agriculture, we manage flows of water and nitrogen across the landscape, and my topic is to consider what are the greenhouse gas implications of those conservation practices. And so I'm going to first start with a couple of concepts that we need to think about to get us thinking about landscapes and to get us thinking about the greenhouse gas implications of landscape practices. I'm going to give two examples of how we've started to make these assessments of the greenhouse gas implications of landscape practices, some work in Rhode Island, some work in North Carolina. And throughout, I'm going to be highlighting what are some of the uncertainties and challenges and also some of the opportunities that we face. We are managing the flows of water and nitrogen across the landscape quite a bit, and there's real uncertainty about what the greenhouse gas implications of that are. I am going to argue that we know a lot about water and nitrogen movement across the landscape, and that knowledge is a very useful platform for us to make these greenhouse gas assessments. Okay, so there are four concepts I think we need to spend a little time with before we go into this. So first there's the idea of let's start thinking about landscapes, and we'll get ourselves into a landscape scale. I will then inflict a little bit of anaerobic biogeochemistry on you, just a little, I promise. Which is really important, though, for helping us thinking about these greenhouse gas implications of landscape practices. And then some accounting tools. What types of tools have we come up to make these landscape scale assessments of greenhouse gas implications? So we'll talk about these cradle-to-grave approaches, and we'll talk about comprehensive greenhouse gas accounting. And then we'll do these concepts and then apply them to a couple of examples. So landscape thinking. So I would argue that one of the great advances in agricultural and environmental sciences over the last 40 years has been our ability to think about the landscape. We now think about landscapes as matrices, niches of sources of pollutants and sinks of pollutants, and we are managing the interaction between sources and sinks to improve the environmental performance of agricultural landscapes. And that's just a huge basic science and applied science advance that we've had. And probably the most obvious manifestations of landscape conservation practices or landscape thinking are riparian zones or constructed wetlands or various types of more advanced engineering structures where we create sinks in the landscape. We hook them up with sources and we improve the environmental performance of landscapes. But now we're starting to get into these questions about, well, are there some side effects? Or if this gives us ecosystem services, are there ecosystem disservices created by these landscape structures that we're making? And so we have these questions about, are we creating hotspots for nitrous oxide and methane production? These are potent greenhouse gases. And then how do we account for the benefits and the disservices or the services and disservices as we think about the landscape? The concerns about greenhouse gases are rooted in anaerobic biogeochemistry. So in most of our, we have sources, which are agricultural fields, which are aerobic, pretty well-drained environments, and most to manage these sinks or to create these sinks, we're creating anaerobic environments. And in particular, we're interested in getting rid of nitrate. So nitrate is our most common and mobile form of nitrogen in the landscape, and denitrification is an anaerobic microbial process that converts nitrate into nitrite and then these nitrogen gases, nitric oxide, nitrous oxide, and dinitrogen. And these are primarily heterotrophic bacteria that carry out this process, and so we expect to find lots of denitrification in wetland soils. Wetlands, because they have anaerobic soils and they have lots of carbon. And indeed, the idea of creating areas that support high denitrification underlies much of our landscape thinking in agriculture. So the problem arises when we would like, nitrate is a real, it's the world's most common water pollutant, and we can convert that into N2, which is a very stable form of nitrogen in the atmosphere, and that's a good outcome. But the concern is these other gases. Nitrous oxide is a very potent greenhouse gas, and nitric oxide is a highly reactive precursor to ozone. And so there's great concern about the nitrous oxide yield of denitrification. And the idea is, if we're creating anaerobic hotspots for denitrification in the landscape, are we also creating hotspots for nitrous oxide? So that's a problem that we're all grappling with. And then, in addition, if we're creating anaerobic environments for denitrification, we also might be creating hotspots for methane production. This is another anaerobic process, even more anaerobic than denitrification. And methane, again, is a very potent greenhouse gas. And so while we're trying to solve a water quality problem, are we creating a greenhouse gas problem? And it all is rooted in these anaerobic processes. And here's just a cartoon to illustrate this landscape conundrum that we face. So we have a crop field. We have nitrate is moving out of the crop field into groundwater, and then the groundwater flows across the landscape. And here's our classic riparian buffer zone. It's wet, anaerobic, high carbon levels, and so there's lots of denitrification in these riparian buffer zones. But the question is, are we also creating hotspots for N2O emission? Are we creating hotspots for methane emission, or maybe even decreasing methane emission? But this is the we have our agricultural landscapes, which tend to be aerobic, and then we have these sources coupled with the sinks, and we have this potential for greenhouse gas production. Okay, so now how can we then start to think about this landscape and to do some type of greenhouse gas accounting, to calculate the services and the disservices associated with managing the landscapes? So the earliest approach was produced by the Intergovernmental Program for Climate Change, the IPCC, which was trying to do a comprehensive accounting of the nitrous oxide effects of fertilizer. And so we apply fertilizer, and the IPCC made a distinction between direct emissions of nitrous oxide and indirect emissions of nitrous oxide associated with fertilizer use. And the direct emissions are, I apply some fertilizer to the field, and some of that's converted to nitrous oxide, say 1%, and that's the direct nitrous oxide emissions. The indirect emissions are harder and are at the center of our attention today, because we know that a certain amount of the fertilizer that we apply to fields leaches and moves across the landscape, just as I showed in this figure over here, right? So that I have direct emissions from the crop field. Now I have nitrates moving across the landscape, and I know nitrous oxide is coming out here in the buffer zone, it's coming out in the stream, it's coming out in the estuary, it's coming out as nitrate travels across the landscape towards the sea. And so in this methodology, they basically said, okay, we're going to assume that 30% of all the fertilizer we apply to fields leaches, and as that fertilizer moves across the landscape, little bits of nitrous oxide are going to be produced as the fertilizer moves through groundwater, as it moves through rivers, and it moves through estuaries. And so this is a cradle-to-grave approach. As the fertilizer moves across the landscape, we're having this full accounting of the nitrous oxide emissions. Now, this methodology conceptually is really quite an advance, because it's this cradle-to-grave approach, and it's based in realism that nitrogen is moving across the landscape. However, it created a massive nervous breakdown in the nitrogen community, because people could argue with many different parts of this methodology. So 30% of fertilizer is certainly, that varies tremendously from place to place, and these emission coefficients vary quite a bit as well. I would argue this methodology was extremely useful, because it was conceptually sound, and it motivated people all over the world to go out and improve these estimates and to improve these coefficients. Now, my complaint with the methodology is it doesn't account for our conservation practices, our landscape-scale conservation practices. So in agriculture, for the last 40 years, we have been managing water and nitrogen flows across the landscape, and the IPCC methodology doesn't consider the nitrous oxide implications of landscape management. So we have been working hard to change the source of nitrogen processing in the landscape by creating riparian zones and constructed wetlands and tile bioreactors, and the IPCC methodology doesn't allow us to address that. And so if we start to think about it, it raises some tricky spatial and temporal questions. Because what we're doing in agriculture is we're changing the place where nitrate is denitrified. We know If nitrate, a molecule of nitrate leaves a crop field, it's going to be denitrified somewhere, either in the riparian zone, in the stream, in the river, in an estuary, or eventually in the deep ocean. That nitrate's going back to the atmosphere somewhere. And the question then is not how much nitrous oxide do I have in this particular riparian zone, but the question is, am I getting more nitrous oxide than if I left that nitrate flow to the sea? And so it becomes a very tricky evaluation, because what we're manipulating nitrogen and water flows across the landscape, and we want to account for the nitrous oxide emissions that we're responsible for by managing those flows, but it has to be a relative evaluation compared to if we had let it flow. It's going to go back to the atmosphere someplace, sometime. Are we creating more nitrous oxide by manipulating the nitrate flow for water quality? So clearly there's a need to produce data on the nitrous oxide and other greenhouse gas implications from these landscape practices. But it's not just nitrous oxide. So as we're managing the landscape and we're creating these anaerobic environments, we have to be concerned about methane, we have to be concerned about CO2 emissions, and we also have to be concerned about soil carbon and plant carbon. So we're creating riparian, where we're storing wetlands, or where we're storing riparian zones or creating new wetlands. Yes, there's nitrous oxide implications, but there's also carbon dioxide, methane, and soil carbon. And these comprehensive accounting creates some real conceptual challenges. For example, so let's say I'm a farmer and I restore a wetland in my landscape. And that wetland produces a lot of methane. Am I responsible for that methane? Maybe I'm just, because this used to be a wetland, it was a natural wetland that produced methane at pretty high rates, so maybe I'm just restoring a natural source of methane and maybe I'm not responsible for that methane. On the other hand, I'm restoring this wetland in a landscape, and soil carbon is piling up, and vegetation carbon is piling up, and do I get credit for that carbon in the soil and the vegetation? Again, I'm just restoring carbon that I might have put in the atmosphere 50 years ago when I originally drained that wetland. And so there are real difficult spatial and temporal issues with methane and with carbon in the soil and carbon in the vegetation that we're going to have to grapple with to come up with a comprehensive accounting of the greenhouse gas implications of landscape features. Okay, so how have we been studying this? So I'm going to give two examples. The first is work in Rhode Island that has really been led by Art Gold and Q Kellogg and a bunch of postdocs and students. And we've been trying to do comprehensive inventories of sources and sinks of nitrogen in this landscape. This is the Chickasheen catchment, which is in coastal New England. There's great concern about nitrogen delivery to coastal waters, which are very sensitive to nitrogen-induced eutrophication. And this is based on a comprehensive inventory of sources and sinks in this landscape. And the sources are silage corn. And the examples I'll give today are, we have silage cornfield linked to a sink in a pond. I have a silage cornfield linked to a riparian zone with hydric soils. And I have a silage cornfield linked to a first-order stream. So we're doing sources and sinks. And the way this works is, so we have pretty good data on how much nitrogen leaves these fields. We know that it leaves the fields and then interacts in the sink. So in this case, our sink is a pond, and we have pretty good data on nitrogen removal in the pond. We know that 68% of the nitrogen that leaves this field is retained in the pond. And we're doing this for our nitrogen accounting. But the question is, how much nitrous oxide and methane are associated with this nitrogen retention? And one of the themes I'm going to make is, we know a lot about the movement of water and nitrogen across many landscapes. What we don't know is the greenhouse gas implications, but these studies should be a very strong platform for us to measure the greenhouse gas fluxes, and so then we'll have a very comprehensive accounting of the nitrogen benefits and the nitrogen and the greenhouse gas implications. So in this case, so we know that about 70% of the nitrogen is disappearing in the pond. We now need to make measurements of nitrous oxide and methane. So we have there's a PhD student, Julia Hyman, is working on this. She has a mesocosm system. She's making measurements of nitrous oxide, CO2, and methane flux in these ponds. And she's starting to produce the data that we need. So she's measuring methane flux. She's measuring methane flux in response to nitrate additions to simulate these nitrate pulses that might move into the pond. And indeed, the methane fluxes in these pond sediments are pretty high, as we might expect. There's a somewhat surprising response to nitrate. We kind of expected the methane fluxes to go down in response to nitrate, but they seem to have gone up. But in any case, this is the type of data that we need. We know what the nitrogen removals are. Here are the methane fluxes. She's also measuring the nitrous oxide fluxes. Again, she has nitrous oxide fluxes in response to the additions of nitrate. Again, a little bit of a surprise. The nitrous oxide rates are low and not necessarily responding to the nitrate additions. But again, she'll continue to make these measurements all day and into the night, and we will then link those to our ongoing studies of nitrogen flows in the landscape, and we'll have a comprehensive assessment of nitrogen benefits and greenhouse gas implications. Second example, I have a silage cornfield next to a riparian zone dominated by hydric soils. Again, we have good data on how much nitrogen leaves this field. We have lots of data on nitrogen removal in riparian zones. We know that 40% of the nitrogen that enters this riparian zone is removed somehow. That's the water quality benefit. Again, what are the greenhouse gas implications of this? Now, many of us have studies like this, where there's lots of active research on riparian zones and ponds and wetlands, where we know the water and nitrogen flows, but we don't know the greenhouse gas implications. And I'm arguing that all of us need to get out there and throw these chambers out into our site. So here's a riparian site. We're standing in the stream. You have a wet part of the riparian zone. You have a drier area. You have a crop field up in the upland. And there's relatively straightforward methods for putting these chambers out where you can then measure in these chambers the fluxes of CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide. And again, I've got a lot of data at a site like this on water and nitrogen movement. So let's piggyback the greenhouse gas measurements on top of those. So this work was led by a postdoc working with us, Amy Bergen, and she was measuring, she had those chambers out there, but she was also measuring, we have a new method for measuring the direct flux of nitrous oxide and N2, dinitrogen, due to denitrification, and she was in a system that allows us to vary the oxygen concentration in this research. It's a soil core recirculation system. And she is producing and starting to produce data on the factors controlling the nitrous oxide yield during denitrification. And a couple of interesting results. These are samples from the drier area of the riparian zone, and they consistently have higher nitrous oxide yields than samples from the wetter end of the riparian zone. And we also see very strong control of the nitrous oxide yield by the oxygen concentration in the incubation system. And so she's produced some pretty strong data on the factors controlling the nitrous oxide yield, which is a very poorly constrained variable currently. So there's a recent review done by Jake Bollier, and he reviewed the nitrous oxide yields in different types of environments. And especially for soils and flooded soils, it's a very poorly constrained variable. But the data suggests that it may be more tractable than we thought. We need to make more measurements of these nitrous oxide yields and how they vary with things that we can measure, soil characteristics and perhaps oxygen levels in the soil. This is the Amy Bergen's work. She's got those chambers out there, and she just does routine measurements of CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane flux, and now she's got a basis for saying, here's our nitrogen removal benefit in this site, and here are our greenhouse gas implications for that. Okay, and then our last example is, so we have a third source, a third silage cornfield. This one here coupled to a first order stream. There's lots of data on nitrogen removal in these first order stream reaches. And again, we're collecting the data. I'm not going to show any of it here, but we're collecting the data on how much nitrous oxide and methane comes out of this stream reach and how is it linked to this nitrogen retention. And so the ultimate goal, so we have two goals in this research. We're trying to do this comprehensive inventory of sources and sinks. So we have our list of nitrogen sources in our landscape. Each of these sources is coupled with a particular sink, and we've got a pretty good picture of landscape nitrogen dynamics, sources and sinks in this landscape. The ongoing effort then is to couple that to the greenhouse gas implications. And so I want to couple my sources. We have these different sinks, and we need to fill in these blanks for the nitrous oxide, methane, CO2, and soil and plant sequestration implications of each of these sinks, and we'll be able to do a total assessment of the greenhouse gas effects. And we'll be able to compare the benefits and the implications, or the services and the disservices in this landscape. And the key point is, you know, we're doing this in many parts of the world. This should be a useful platform for us to get at these things that we don't know. I wanted to give one more example of a study that's a little farther down the road than us in doing this in our work in Rhode Island. This is work that comes from the Timberlake Wetland Restoration Project. This is in Coastal Plain of North Carolina. And this is work, there's a postdoc who's working with us now, Jen Morse, did this for her dissertation, working with a group of scientists at Duke and UNC. So this is a pretty large site. There's areas of active agriculture. There's a large area of restored wetland. All right, so here's active agriculture, restored wetlands, and then there are a couple of reference wetlands, natural wetlands. And so this allows her to make these comparisons between reference wetlands, active agriculture, and restored wetlands. And the big question driving this was, okay, we're going to do a big wetland restoration in this watershed. Is this going to create a greenhouse gas nightmare? And there was just the concern that nitrous oxide and methane was going to come pouring out of these restored wetlands. And this is a very strong experimental design for comparing active agriculture, restored wetlands, and reference wetlands. And the results are very interesting. So again, you're able to compare all these different gases by converting them to CO2 equivalents, right? So nitrous oxide, methane, and CO2 can all be put on the same basis based on their global warming potential. So everything's expressed in CO2 equivalents. She has active agriculture, three restored wetlands, and two natural wetlands. And the restored wetlands are clearly not huge sources of greenhouse gas emissions. The active agriculture has quite a bit of greenhouse gas implications. It produces a lot of CO2 and a lot of nitrous oxide. These reference wetlands also produce lots of CO2, and they also have a bunch of methane associated with them. And the restored wetlands are just in between. They're certainly not any higher than either the active agriculture or these natural wetlands. And this is a very encouraging result because it suggests that our efforts to restore wetlands to improve water quality, at least in this case, are not creating a greenhouse gas nightmare in this landscape. Okay, so some conclusions. Again, I think one of the great advances in agricultural environment and environmental sciences over the last 40 years has our ability to think about and manage landscapes to improve their environmental performance. And we've made great progress at doing that. We're now faced with the question of evaluating the greenhouse gas implications of those approaches. I would argue that we're extremely well poised to do this because we have active research in many parts of the world where we're measuring these water and nitrogen flows, and we have a real opportunity to get a quantitative links between our nitrogen benefits and our greenhouse gas implications. And I think we can do that relatively efficiently because we have existing research structures up and running. But we need a lot of data, and we need to get the data. We need to incorporate it into our models, our water quality-based models, and our decision-making tools so that we can start to make these we can balance our water quality objectives and our greenhouse gas objectives. And I'm very interested to see how it's going to turn out, right? So I've got showed you a little bit of data that suggests that landscape management is not going to create a big greenhouse gas problem, but that's just a couple of studies, and there's a real need for data in many other places. And let's get those into our models and decision-making tools, and I think we can then move ahead and manage both water and greenhouse gas implications in our ag landscapes. All right, thank you for your attention.
As you mentioned, carbon sequestration in those balances, like even in the trees.
Right. So that has to be done. Right.
But in the graph that you showed, are you accounting for carbon sequestration for trees, tree and both?
Right, so in the Timberlake example, that was not accounting for carbon sequestration in the soils and the trees. But the question is, so let's say I'm accumulating carbon in the soils and in the trees, do I get credit for that? Because 50 years ago, I drained that same wetland and put all that carbon into the atmosphere from the soil and the trees, so now I'm getting it back.
But if you harvest the tree and then let them grow again, I mean...
So I think that we have to come to some type of decision about what we're going to do about the soil and plant carbon sequestration, and what do we get credit for, and what do we not get credit for. But it's very important, and not super hard to. I can quantify the carbon for you, but whether I'm going to get credit for that's our next speaker.
Yeah. Based on your work in a literature review, would you say that in highly reducing waterlogged conditions, you can generally say denitrification goes all the way to dinitrogen gas rather than N2O, or can you not make that difference?
Well, so what I've discovered, and I've been working on this for some number of decades, is that the soil microbes are not reading the literature or the textbooks. And so I would like to say that, but I can't. You can't. There are lots of nitrous oxide, particularly nitrous oxide, there are lots of surprises. Louis?
I was actually just following up on that. Do you think that the emission factor increases as you have more nitrate coming through? So in other words, if you have agricultural systems that intensify, should the emission factor increase as well?
I mean, it should. Right, so and this whole question of if we trap a bunch of nitrate in a riparian zone and denitrify there, instead of letting it flow to the sea, we should be getting higher emission factors because it's concentrated. But it depends on how well we manage those sinks. So if I have a riparian zone which has a relatively short residence time and a lot of nitrate, I'm going to get a lot of nitrous oxide. If I have a denitrification wall, then I might get a much lower yield. So conceptually, yes, we should be worried about this because I think we should be increasing the nitrous oxide yield by managing the nitrogen flows.
So again, if I could respond to that, then we need to design these systems so that we are managing for removing that nitrate at just the same time as so that it all goes, so that we get rid of the nitrous oxide as well.
We should, yes, and I think so. Now, once we start to make these measurements, it becomes part of the design and the performance standards for all our practices, and we should think about the methane. The other thing you should get is you should get less methane, right? So if you have a high nitrate environment thermodynamically, you should get more denitrification and less methane. But again, you look at Julia's data, that's not what she observed. And again, the soil microbes are not as learned in thermodynamics as we would hope.
Thank you, Peter.